social system of racism, of exclusion that existed into the 20th century. So, you know, that's not unique to Peru, but I think I think what is told for, you know, should be told in general in the world is that, you know, it's better if you look at things, you know, try to sit back and take a look at them. I think you could do much more than putting labels. When you put labels on people, you're saying it's the us them. And when you say us them, it's dangerous because it makes you think that you're somehow superior to a quote, a them. And I think that's one of the things that I really think came out in Peru, particularly in the case of my case and other people, is like you want the them label because you can sort of all of your guilt you can sort of transfer to other people. And it's like that's not useful. Then you wind up having, you know, violence can escalate. It's not productive. It doesn't lead to anything.
That's Lori Berenson, the once imprisoned U.S. activist, home now after spending nearly two decades in prison and on parole in Peru. To see our coverage of Lori over the years, go to democracynow.org. Special thanks to Mike Burke, Amy Littlefield, Juan Carlos Davila, Carla Wills, Dina Guzder, Renee Feltz, and Robbie Caron. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Tune in to the podcast Probable Cause This on the KBOO website, kboo.fm/probablecause. On this podcast, I look at the top stories on the lack of accountability for police and public officials in Oregon and across the country. That's kboo.fm/probablecause for a weekly roundup of stories on holding our public officials accountable to we the people.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month is Nacho Drum, showing Thursday, January 21st at 7 p.m. Released in 1993, Nacho Drum is a French documentary about the Romani people's journey from Northwest India to Spain, consisting primarily of music. Again, that's Nacho Drum, Thursday, January 21st, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
I always say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
Hi, I'm Shahid Hamid. With each passing year, the words of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. become more and more necessary to remember. With this in mind, the World Arts Foundation and KBOO Foundation members would like to invite you, your family, and friends to their 31st anniversary and tribute to the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Monday, January the 18th, broadcast live from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. from Highland Christian Center in Portland. As in years past, there will be a variety of local and regional choirs, performers, and entertainers, all paying homage to the work and legacy of Dr. King and our efforts to keep his dream alive. So remember, Monday, January the 18th at the Highland Christian Center, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., and of course, right here on KBOO FM radio.
The greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
The time is 5:02 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, armed white militants continue their standoff with law enforcement in Harney County.
A mosque in Florida was vandalized over the weekend.
And President Obama today announced plans to introduce a series of gun control initiatives.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 4th, 2016. I'm Joanna Peterson.
And I'm Ken Jones. KBOO volunteer Nate Bensky has been reported missing and has not been seen since late New Year's Eve. Nate is a white male, about 6 feet tall, with brown hair and dark blue eyes. He's approachable and polite to a fault. If you see Nate, please call 971-409-7567 or call us here at KBOO at 503-231-8032.
As of today, Oregonians can apply online for recreational marijuana business licenses. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission opened the online application system early this morning. The agency is expecting hundreds to apply for licenses to grow, process, and sell marijuana in Oregon. The OLCC will stagger the licensing process, first reviewing applications for testing labs and outdoor gardens. The online application system is a step toward Oregon's goal to implement a well-regulated marijuana program. Since October 2015, licensed dispensaries have been able to sell seeds, cones, and flower to recreational customers. Later this year, after businesses are properly licensed, the recreational retail market for cannabis is expected to expand to offer edibles and concentrates.
Portland thawed out a bit this afternoon from our recent stretch of snow, ice, and freezing rain, but colder conditions are on the way. A severe weather warning has been issued for Multnomah County for this evening. The National Weather Service forecasts wind chill temperatures between 21 and 25 degrees. Road conditions could be slick. If you have to be out there in your car, leave early. Go easy on the gas and gentle on the brakes. You can find the latest list of road closures online at the Portland Bureau of Transportation website. Just search for PBOT, P-B-O-T. If you're taking public transportation, check for route delays and cancellations on the TriMet site. That's trimet.org/alerts or on TriMet's Twitter account. Multnomah County has opened several warming shelters for anyone needing a warm place to sleep tonight. To find one near you, call 211 or go online to 211info.org.
Media from around the world converged on Tiny Burns, Oregon this weekend. What began as a legal battle between some cattle ranchers and the Bureau of Land Management escalated over the weekend into an armed standoff that is still going on. Dwight Hammond and his son Stephen were convicted of arson in federal court in 2001 and again in 2006. They were given a sentence that was much less than the mandatory minimum. The government successfully appealed their sentences, and the Hammonds were resentenced to their full 5 years. First, for an update on the situation in Burns, we go to Harney County Sheriff Dave Ward at a news conference earlier today.
The Hammonds have turned themselves in today at 1:37 p.m. in accordance with the law, and are currently in custody in a federal correctional institution in California. Harney County is a community of approximately 7,000 people. Most of us, about 5,000, live here in the communities of Burns and Hines. This event has significantly impacted our community. Our goal is to work together and restore calm and regular services for the people of that community. This incident originally started out when people from outside of the area and state arrived in an attempt to prevent the Hammonds from returning to prison. This began as a peaceful protest. It took an unfortunate turn when some of those folks broke off and began an armed occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. The Harney County Commissioners and I have requested law enforcement assistance from the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Oregon State Police. Sheriff's offices from around the state have also sent resources to assist us. We requested this additional support to make sure that the citizens of Harney County are safe. This is our top priority. I want to talk directly to the people at the Wildlife Refuge. You said you were here to help the citizens of Harney County. That help ended when a peaceful protest became an armed occupation. The Hammonds have turned themselves in. It's time for you to leave our community, go home to your families, and end this peacefully. Thanks for your time.
That was Harney County Sheriff Dave Ward speaking about the standoff at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge between law enforcement and a small band of armed white protesters. The armed protesters are led by Ammon Bundy, son of Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy, whose ranch was the site of another standoff between law enforcement and armed white right-wingers in 2014. Some libertarians argue that there are legitimate concerns regarding federal management of public lands in the Hammond case. Those concerned are overshadowed. KB reporter Doug McVeigh spoke with Randall O'Toole, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, to find out more.
Well, my take on it is that nobody is doing the right thing. There's no good guys here to root for. But the Hammonds, the ranchers who are going to jail for supposed arson, are probably the fall guys here. They did not need to go to jail for that. They were doing what was a few years ago been considered to be normal, ecologically sound practices of prescribed burning, and by putting them in jail for 5 years for arson, we're sending a message that anybody who tries to do ecologically sound practices on their own land, if they're near federal land, risks going to jail for 5 years. I think that's terrible. Now, they made some mistakes. They didn't get a waiver. They were burning during a part of fire season when there was a ban on fire. They decided it was too important to protect their land. They were doing a backfire to protect their land from a wildfire on federal land that was threatening their land. And they decided they didn't have enough time to get a waiver, so they did the backfire. I think there are some communication problems. They've had conflicts with the federal government over water and other issues in recent years, over hunting. They've had conflicts with wildlife hunting guides and things like that. Really, the problem is that federal lands are political lands. They're decided politically, and so everybody is polarizing things as much as they can in order to get the biggest political outcome for their side. And, you know, we saw this in the timber wars in the 1980s. We're having grazing wars about it now. We've had mining wars about it. We need to depoliticize the land management to be able to solve these problems.
But then along comes the Bundys.
Well, the Bundys are coming from an ideological viewpoint that actually many people at the Cato Institute probably support, which is that the Constitution says that the federal government can own land inside the District of Columbia and nowhere else. Now, the reality is that since 1790, the federal government has owned millions of acres of land outside of Washington, D.C., and the Supreme Court has never said it was unconstitutional. So they don't have a legal leg to stand on, and I don't think their practices on the lands they were leasing in Nevada are all that sound. So they don't really have a ecological leg to stand on like the Hammonds do, but they definitely are polarizing the situation, and I don't think anybody in Washington, D.C. would have heard of the Hammonds if it hadn't been for the Bundys. So if President Obama gives the Hammonds a pardon, which I think he ought to do, maybe the Bundys deserve some credit for that.
Taking aside the militants and looking just at the situation with the conflict between BLM and ranchers, is there some kind of middle ground that they can seek?
Well, I think the conflicts really go back to 1978. Before then, the ranchers paid fair market value for grazing. And there were a lot of years in which the federal government actually earned a profit on grazing. And then in 1978, the ranchers persuaded Congress to mandate a grazing fee that was well below fair market value. And since then, people in the agency have increasingly seen the ranchers as freeloaders because it costs over $100 million a year to provide range for them, and they're paying almost nothing in return. So they view the ranchers as freeloaders, and they view the cattle and sheep as foreign intruders on native wildlife habitat. That's not good publicity for the ranchers, and I think the ranchers need to buckle up and say, if we're going to be here, we need to pay our fair share just like everybody else should pay their fair share.
Well, I've been speaking with Randall O'Toole. He is an Oregonian and a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Mr. O'Toole, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
The Malheur Wildlife Refuge was created at the turn of the century, and it's regarded as a very important part of the federal system. To learn more about the Malheur Refuge, Doug spoke with Bob Salinger with the Audubon Society of Portland.
Yeah, we're very concerned about the armed takeover of Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. The refuge is really one of the crown jewels of the refuge system. It's an incredibly important refuge for migratory birds. The armed takeover is entirely illegal. It is basically a bunch of out-of-state folks coming in and hijacking this refuge to pursue their own very, very narrow political agenda. And they need to be removed and they need to be prosecuted. What they're using as a pretext for the takeover of Malheur is actually two ranchers that were convicted of arson, and they are protesting the sentence that they received for that arson. I think what's really notable is the fact that the two people that were convicted have made it very clear that they did not request the support of these militia folks, and they have not endorsed the takeover. And the community did not request and does not support the takeover. So, you know, they've come in here under this really false pretext and used it as an excuse to, you know, grab these public lands that belong to all of us. So that's really, you know, the excuse that they've been using. But it's really a joke. I mean, you know, apparently these guys can't find anybody who actually wants them to support their cause. So they impose themselves on Harney County and Malheur, claiming to be helping to support the community when the community has been very clear they don't want them there. So, you know, I think what this is basically some folks who have a very radical political agenda. You know, come in here and take in these public lands, and it's time to take them back.
All right, Bob, any closing thoughts for the listeners?
Yeah, you know, I think it's very disappointing that they chose Malheur in particular, you know, because there's a lot of very good collaborative work going on there that involves the local community that's been ongoing for quite some time. And I think that's what I hope folks will return to once this standoff is over, is that, you know, there's some incredible work that's going on there that involves the local communities, local ranchers, local politicians, environmental groups, the refuge, the tribes. Really, really important work that's going to be good for the environment and good for the economy. And once the militia is removed, I think it's critical that we return to that and we double down on it and we put resources in to move forward together on the refuge and reinvigorate that work. It's now even more important. But, you know, I think for right now, the key is these folks need to be removed and they need to be prosecuted. I mean, they went into public lands, they took over public property, they brought guns, they've issued threats, and, you know, it needs to end, and they need to be prosecuted for what they've done. And, you know, we hope that happens quickly. One other thing I would add, too, is this is an incredibly important wildlife refuge. It was set aside in 1908 by Theodore Roosevelt, and he recognized that this is an incredibly important place for birds, really one of the most important refuges in the United States. At that time, birds were being killed, wanton slaughter, for their feathers that were used in the hat fashion industry. And, you know, the setting aside of Malheur was to stop that wanton slaughter and to protect these incredibly important wetlands for migratory birds. You know, we addressed a threat a little over a century ago. Now there's a new threat, and you know, we hope the state and federal authorities step in and address it as quickly as possible.
Great. Well, I've been speaking with Bob Salinger. He's the conservation director at the Audubon Society of Portland. They're on the web at audubonportland.org. And Bob, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
Following the newscast on tonight's in-depth report, KBOO's Paul Rowland interviews Spencer Sunshine from Political Research Associates, so stay tuned.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Spencer Sunshine of Political Research Associates about the ongoing situation in Harney County and the ties between the armed white militants and other right-wing extremists. This will be followed at 6 by Labor Radio's Coalition of Black Trade Unionists, which features an interview with Dr. Stephen C. Pitts, an associate chair at the Labor Center at UC Berkeley. Professor Pitts talks with members of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists about the need for black workers to organize. That's followed at 7 by Prison Pipeline. Host Ruth Kovacs interviews Patricia Daniels, Executive Director of Constructing Hope, a pre-apprenticeship program that rebuilds the lives of people in our community by encouraging self-sufficiency through skills, training, and education in the construction industry. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather: chance of rain before 10 p.m., then rain likely, possibly mixed with freezing rain. Cloudy with a low around 32. Little or no ice accumulation is expected overnight. Then Tuesday, rain is likely, possibly mixed with freezing rain before 10 a.m., then a chance of just rain. Again, little or no ice accumulation is expected, but still be careful out there. Today in history, in 1965, the free speech movement held its first rally in Sproul Plaza at the University of California, Berkeley. And in 1974, President Richard M. Nixon refused to hand over tape recordings and documents that had been subpoenaed by the Senate Watergate Committee, setting off a series of events that culminated in President Nixon resigning in disgrace. The quote of the day is from Mario Savio, one of the leaders of the Berkeley Free Speech Movement, who said, "There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part, you can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all."
It's 5:21, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Back in 2008, Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein declared, "There are parts of government that can be run like a business and should be run like a business." Thus, the chairwoman of the Senate Committee overseeing congressional facilities privatized the restaurants and other food services in the U.S. Senate. Sure enough, those dining spots now turn a profit because they are being run like a business, specifically a business like McDonald's. Restaurant Associates, the New York outfit that got the House and Senate food contract, profits by paying poverty-level wages and generally mistreating the cooks, waitstaff, and other people who put the service in food service. Wages are less than $11 an hour, well below the very expensive cost of living in the Washington area. "Everybody has second jobs," says one weary worker. And when our $174,000 a year members of Congress adjourn for the 3 months or so of vacations they take each year, the food service workers are sent away with no pay at all. I should note that Restaurant Associates did give a pay raise to some workers not long ago. It was 3 cents an hour. That's not a raise, it's an insult. "I serve food to some of the most powerful people on earth," says a Senate cook. "They often talk of expanded opportunity for workers, but most don't seem to notice or care that workers in their own building are struggling to survive." Care? A key Senate committee chairman, Representative Tom Graves, recently showed how much Congress cares about the inequality by refusing even to consider requiring food service contractors to pay a living wage. "It's really not within the scope of this committee to micromanage all contracts," he sniffed. This is Jim Hightower saying, think of how that makes the Capitol dining staff feel. If I was old Tom, from now on, I wouldn't eat anywhere in the Capitol without taking a food taster with me.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
Last year was El Salvador's deadliest since the country's civil war, according to figures released today by government authorities. El Salvador experienced a 70% spike in violent deaths in 2015, amid a rise in mass killings and conflicts between alleged gang members and police in the country. Overall, the murder rate increased to 104 per 100,000 residents, compared to 1 per 100,000 in the UK and 90 per 100,000 in Venezuela, which is the second most murderous country in 2015. El Salvador has a population of about 6.4 million people. Last year's death toll is the highest recorded in the country since 1983, at the peak of a 12-year civil war fought between the U.S.-backed military dictatorship and left-wing guerrilla groups. The current violence is mostly concentrated in urban areas, but the gangs are rapidly expanding into the countryside in order to run extortion rings and control territory.
Muslim leaders are asking the federal government to investigate a mosque attack, which took place in Central Florida last Friday, as a hate crime. Someone tore apart the mosque with a machete and left bacon by the front door. Muslim religious law forbids the eating of pork products. Police have a surveillance video of someone breaking into the mosque, located in Titusville on Florida's east coast, and said shattering lights and windows. Police have not identified the attacker, but say they have several strong leads at this time. The incident is just one in a wave of attacks on places where Muslims worship in America. In the past week, mosques have been hit by arson in California and vandalism in Georgia. A report released by the Council of American Islamic Relations states that mosques have been targeted more than 70 times in 2015, the most incidents ever recorded in terms of damage, vandalism, and intimidation.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. SEIU Local 73 in Chicago will push for the city to arm hundreds of its members serving as airport security officers at O'Hare and Midway airports. SEIU 73 Secretary Treasurer Matt Brandon says these officers have police training, but since they're unarmed, they've been told to run and hide if violence breaks out. The union wants these officers to be allowed to carry guns.
First of all, it's a personal safety problem because a lot of these men and women guard what are known as the access entry points to the airfield. The gates that lead directly to the airfield are aviation police officers responsible for allowing traffic in, checking IDs, those kinds of things. So they're at vital safety points at the airport, along with patrolling the terminals and different areas of the airport, but they're unarmed. In today's climate, we think that's ridiculous.
Brandon says the union will press the city of Chicago to arm these officers.
We're going to petition the city council, the Department of Aviation chair, for a hearing. I plan to petition the mayor personally and ask him to get involved because we think it's time that the airports have the proper security. We have a force of approximately 400 men and women at both airports, Midway and O'Hare together. And we believe that for flying public safety and for their own personal safety, they need to be armed.
Planned deportation raids against undocumented immigrants from Central America could begin this month and may affect as many as 13,000 people. Oscar Chacon is executive director of Alianza Americas and a frequent lecturer on immigrant issues. Speaking on WBAI's Building Bridges program, he says many of these immigrants fled violence in Central America, and Obama should not be targeting them in deportation raids.
It would create havoc, you know, within thousands of homes, thousands of households. There will be a lot of collateral cost involved in this kind of operation. And we feel very strongly that right now what the president should do, if he really wants to shake off the notion that he is indeed deporter-in-chief, is to backtrack on this plan and acknowledge that this particular population deserves protection and not detention and deportation.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at IBEW.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
President Obama today announced plans to introduce a series of gun control initiatives during the next several days. He said that enacting the measures would probably include using executive orders to bypass Congress. Obama did not describe his proposals, but he's expected to address a loophole that has allowed certain gun sales without background checks. This announcement came after the president met with top law enforcement officials at the White House today. And even though the Obama administration has not yet detailed his plans to reduce gun violence, Republicans are already criticizing his use of executive power to make changes.
The U.S. stock market opened the year on a down note today, falling sharply on worries about China's economy and the diplomatic conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran. The Dow Jones dropped 276.09 points, or 1.58%. The S&P 500 fell 31.28, or 1.53%. And the tech-heavy NASDAQ composite was down 104.32, or 2.08%. The losses in the U.S. market follow similar losses in Asia and Europe after the Chinese stock market plummeted 7% due to a report on a weak manufacturing activity. In addition, a report from the Institute for Supply Management showed U.S. manufacturing activity contracted in December for the second straight month. Analysts also point to concern about violent protests in Iran against the Saudi execution of a prominent Shiite cleric.
The holiday season is observed in a variety of ways. For some, it's a time of reflection. For others, it means being able to take time off from work or school and spend time with family. But one element has become a constant, a barrage of advertising. Many people engage in the rampant consumerism, and others tune out the marketing messages. Free Speech Radio's Johnny Blackhardy reports on one Melbourne man's mission to beat back the onslaught of advertising in public spaces.
It's 2 o'clock on a Friday afternoon in Melbourne's busy financial district. Armed with a bucket of glue and hundreds of sheets of black paper, a man walks up to the electronic billboard at a tram stop. Slowly and methodically, he begins pasting black pieces of paper over the ads.
My name is Kyle McGee. I'm 32, and I think the first time I went out and painted a billboard, I was 21. So I've been doing this off and on since then.
Ad busting is a form of protest that involves altering commercial advertisements. However, unlike regular ad busting, often done at night and in secret, Kyle does his out in the open, in broad daylight. After covering over the advertisements, he also posts a piece of paper outlining his philosophy and linking to his website. He isn't hiding at all.
Why do we accept constant for-profit advertising in our public spaces and across our media? We pay for it, we suffer it, and we let it manipulate the defenseless minds of our children.
He says authors such as Naomi Klein and Noam Chomsky helped him articulate his thinking about media and society, but he wanted to take it to the next level.
Yeah, I guess I found it frustrating that all these academics had written these awesome books about how the media is corrupted and all this, but they were unwilling to do anything other than publish books. That is, you know, something, but in light of the consequences, I think we should be trying to do a little bit more than that. I mean, to engage the mainstream on these subjects instead of just preaching to a niche of liberal-minded people, you're going to have to take things into the physical realm, start living your ideas a bit more, standing up for them.
But standing up in public has had its costs as well. McGee has regularly been arrested and charged during his protest and has been to prison for short stints on several occasions. His most recent hearing was at the Melbourne Magistrates Court, where he was charged with the crime of willful damage and posting bills. Recording isn't allowed inside, but McGee admitted openly to his actions. However, he refused to do community service or pay fines, and the judge sentenced him to 7 days in prison. His friends, as well as his three-year-old daughter and her mother, were in the courtroom to support him.
But having my daughter there was at a really big effect on me that I didn't expect. You know, I got a sentence of only 7 days, but because my daughter was there, I just looked at her and it just made me want to cry.
A few weeks later and he was out of jail and out posting again. McGee lives in squats and doesn't have traditional employment. This protest is his job. Out on the street, he works covering half a dozen billboards at the tram stop, as several of his friends film and take photos. Onlookers express mixed reactions.
So what do I think? Oh, he's got a right to have his opinion, doesn't he? Do you think people are going to get it, though? I think it certainly shows a level of commitment to the stand he's taking. I don't know if there are many people in the 21st century who are prepared to go to prison for what they believe in, certainly not in Australia.
I mean, I guess our world is saturated with advertising and we can't escape it. And that's not great, that's not really a choice. Like, if you want to escape from advertising, what do you do? Where do you go? Like, buy your own private island? I mean, it's freedom of speech. Like, you shouldn't go to prison for freedom of speech. Damaging property that's, like, in public. So I think, why should advertisers be able to pay to push their message in our faces, and public citizens who are just out and about in the city, which is should be their home, aren't allowed to do the same.
Protest is one thing, but to do something that's not to a property that's not yours, that's another. Well, I'm sure there's other ways to get your message out. You know, people get messages out all the time without having to do this.
He's been sent to prison before for doing this. Do you think that that's a fair response?
Well, clearly it didn't teach him a lesson, did it? If it did, well, he wouldn't be doing it again.
Meter does what it does, and he's finding his way of doing it, but he's got to find a legal way of doing it, not like this.
Oh, look, I think, look at the kind of advertising that we get with betting syndicates and all those kind of things. It's just disgraceful, and, you know, they just prey on the weakness of human beings, and I think it's fantastic what he's doing. Good on him.
And so he's been doing this for about 10 years.
Has he?
He's actually been sent to prison a few times.
You're kidding. It's incredible, isn't it? You can be in a bank and take people's money and destroy lives, but this guy can make an honest assessment of society and get put in prison. It's crazy, isn't it? It's the world we live in, unfortunately.
The police don't come on this particular day, and after postering over about a dozen billboards at the tram stop, McGee and his friends head off. He is adamant that he will continue this protest as a form of civil disobedience, saying he can't be himself without doing what he cares about. Johnny Blackali, FSRN, Melbourne.
The governor of a Mexican state just south of Mexico City has announced new security measures following the weekend assassination of a newly sworn-in mayor. The murder adds to a long list of local elected officials assassinated in Mexico in recent years. Shannon Young, from Free Speech Radio News, reports.
33-year-old Gisela Mota, a former Mexican congresswoman with the center-left PRD party, became the latest mayor to be assassinated in Mexico when a group of gunmen broke into her home on the morning of January 2nd and shot her dead in front of her family. The day before, she had taken the oath of office as mayor of Temisco, a city on the outskirts of the Morelos state capital, Cuernavaca. On Sunday, Morelos Governor Graco Ramirez blamed Mota's murder on organized crime and called it a threat to all newly instated local officials. He announced a so-called unified command force would immediately take over policing duties in Temisco and 14 other municipalities in the state. Unified command structures include state, federal, and military forces. Proponents of the model say it's a way of combating endemic corruption within municipal police forces. Critics say it undercuts local control of policing without addressing the underlying issue of corruption within official ranks. One official who has reacted strongly to the governor's announcement is the new mayor of the state capital, former soccer star Cuauhtémoc Blanco, who took to the airwaves of Mexican media on Monday, saying that if anything happened to him, to hold the governor responsible. The state capital of Cuernavaca was once a major tourism magnet and a choice location for vacation homes of Mexico City's wealthy class. But years of kidnappings, extortion, and murders have affected the city's image, economy, and quality of life. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, January 4th, 2016. Six Palestinians injured in separate Israeli attacks in the West Bank. Meanwhile, in Gaza, Israeli troops target farmers. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian teenager was injured and arrested by Israeli police in Jerusalem on Monday evening, Israeli media sources reported. The 17-year-old teen was shot and injured by Israeli police near the tram station in West Jerusalem. The Israeli police claimed that he stabbed a soldier and a settler before he was shot and arrested by officers. Israeli media sources said that the two Israelis were moved to hospital after sustaining light wounds. Elsewhere, five Palestinians were injured on Monday when a house caught fire in Jayuz village near Qalqilya city in northern West Bank. The house caught fire when Israeli soldiers invaded the village and fired tear gas into residents' homes, local sources reported. The five were moved to hospital in Qalqilya city, two in critical condition, Palestinian sources added. Early on Monday at dawn, Israeli soldiers kidnapped three young Palestinian men from occupied East Jerusalem, one in Jenin and two others in Ramallah and Bethlehem, in addition to one Palestinian at the Hawara roadblock near Nablus. In addition, at least eight Palestinians have been kidnapped on Monday at dawn after dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded Al-Fuwa refugee camp east of Nablus and Tel Village west of the city. Also on Monday at dawn, dozens of soldiers invaded several Palestinian communities in the southern West Bank district of Hebron, searched many homes and kidnapped six Palestinians. In other news, Israeli soldiers stationed across the border fence fired several rounds of live ammunition targeting Palestinian farmers in their lands east of Gaza City. Media sources said that soldiers on military towers surrounding the Nahal Oz military base east of the Shuja'iya neighborhood opened fire on the farmers as they were trying to work in their own farmlands. Fearing additional military escalation, the farmers left their lands and headed back to their homes. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, January 4th, 2016 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Jory Shmawi and me, Ghassan Banoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Paul Rowland, Joanna Peterson, and Ken Jones. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Our engineer is Mike Fotoklis. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Joanna Peterson. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9, author and researcher Tim Flannery speaks on solution to the climate crisis. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, DeMay Roberts features the world premiere play Broken Promises by Olga Sanchez. She talks with Danielle Milan, founder and artistic director of Teatro Milagro, and actor Giovanni Alva. Oluinka Ajinjo of Rejoice Diaspora Dance Theater about their performance of Ancestry in Motion. At 11:30 on Art Focus, we'll hear how women used art and humor to campaign for social justice around the world in 2015. Thanks for listening, and thanks, KABU members, for your generous support in 2015.
And stay tuned now for an interview with Spencer Sunshine of Political Research Associates about the ongoing situation in Harney County and the ties between the armed white militants and other right-wing extremists. Good night, Joanna.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Mike.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
A small group of armed, white, right-wing militants are occupying buildings at a national wildlife refuge outside Burns, Oregon. They claimed when they arrived that they were there to support Dwight and Stephen Hammond, two Harney County cattle ranchers who had been convicted of federal arson charges. The Hammonds are being sent back to federal prison after the government won an appeal over their sentencing. Yet the militants, led by Ammon Bundy, seem to have another agenda. KABU reporter Paul Rowland spoke with Spencer Sunshine, an associate fellow with Political Research Associates, to learn more.
Tell us